Hey, what's up? Hello, future casters. Thank you for tuning into yet another episode of Past, Present, Future Cast. I am your host and tarot guide, Maria Elena Pakulis, and this week we have another timely listener question. This listener asked, is summer magic different from spring, winter, and fall? How so? Should my magical practice look different in each season? It's the very last day of June as I'm recording this, which means that we just crossed over the threshold into the summer season here in the Northern Hemisphere. The summer solstice was just 10 days ago on June 20th, so the changing of the seasons is certainly on my mind right now. This question really makes me think about some of the origins of my personal magical practice. And to fully answer the question, I think I should first define what a magical practice means to me. The practice part for me is mostly a practice of observation and learning from that observation. The magic of it all, again, for me, is about nature, the earth, the universe. So my magical practice is really a practice of observing and studying the natural world around me and basing my values, choices, and worldview around that. The actual craft of being a witch, you know, witchcraft, is in using this wisdom and information to enhance, alter, harness, or otherwise manipulate the world around us. And I honestly practice witchcraft a lot less than you might think. So when we ask the question, is summer magic different from spring, winter, and fall? I offer the advice to look outside. The appearance, feel, activities, and processes of summer are radically different to those of winter or spring or fall. Naturally, as we are inherently part of nature, our magical practices might look different too. Now, there are also a lot of similarities to these seasons, and I'll touch on that in a minute. But I'm not here to tell you what you should or should not do. I can only share with you my experience, and my experience is that my practice evolved almost entirely out of observing and marking the changing of the seasons. I started by making an altar space that was just a grouping of trinkets and decor items with some candles, because I like candles, that matched the vibe of each season. Basically, it was the pagan equivalent of those goose statues where you change their outfit each holiday. From there, I observed things like how the light changes, what the animals and the plants in my area were doing, and what sort of activities felt right for the time. For a really beautiful exploration on this kind of spiritual study through the observation of nature, I highly recommend Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass. But I'm going to digress a little bit and remind you that I said summer has just begun in the Northern Hemisphere. When attempting to gain universal wisdom through observation, you do have to observe the whole universe, or at least the whole planet to start. And I could go into how astrology is a key tool in this kind of observational study, but I will leave that for another time. We'll stick to just planet Earth today. So the Earth is always balancing the seasons in either hemisphere. And by that, I mean when it's summer in the Northern Hemisphere, it's winter in the Southern Hemisphere. This is why it's hot in Australia for Christmas, right? And apologies to any Australians listening who are like, yeah, duh. The Northern Hemisphere is so dominant in popular culture that I honestly didn't fully comprehend this until I was in my 20s. Like, I knew that the seasons were flipped in each hemisphere, but it didn't, like, sink in that people are living in winter at the same time that I'm living in the summer. So I just want to make sure that all of my fellow Northerners are following along here. This means that summer and winter solstices are always occurring simultaneously. And this has a lot to teach us from a magical perspective. One thing I think winter and summer have in common is there's this popular narrative encouraging us to do more during these times. In the winter, we have all of these holidays and holiday parties and family obligations and activities to run to. But when we look at nature, we see a very different picture. We see rest, hibernation, storing energy to ride out the long, dark nights, extra sleep. These natural themes are most prominent in areas that have extreme winters, with very little light, very low temps, and lots of snow. Summertime is also a time when there is a narrative of activity. School's out, so it's time to travel, explore the outdoors, go swimming, go surfing, have barbecues. But I happen to live in an area with really extreme summers, and I notice that this is also really a time of rest, hibernation, and storing enough resources like water to ride out the long, dry summer. The days are longer, so we stay up later and wake up earlier to beat the heat. But the rabbits and the squirrels outside my window are absolutely getting extra sleep in the shade in the middle of the day, when the sun is harshest and there's not much else to do but conserve your energy and hydration or risk heat exhaustion. My Mexican ancestors definitely had it right when it came to the concept of the siesta. A nice nap in the middle of the day helps us survive a harsh summer. So when it comes to the question, is summer magic different from the other seasons? The answer is both and. Summer and winter are wildly opposite times that can be honored in wildly different ways, but they also offer similarities, and we can learn from both the comparison and the contrast. The same can be said for spring and fall. So what other ways do you look to the earth as a teacher? Let me know in the comments or send me a message at persephonictarot.com. You can also submit your own question to be featured on an episode of Past, Present, Futurecast. Before we get into this week's interview, I want to let you know that my books are back open for tarot and astrology readings. I have 3 reading options available: a straight just tarot reading, astro tarot readings where we look at your natal chart and transits and then create a tarot reading around that information, and moon readings where I look closely at how an upcoming full or new moon is impacting you personally and send you your own little personal podcast audio recording with all of the details. Spots are limited, so please head to persephonictarot.com/services to book. That's persephonictarot.com/services. Now on to this week's interview. I am here with Camille T. McDaniel. Camille is a Portland, Oregon-based book editor and fiber artist. Her poetry has been published in Black Fox Literary Magazine, Currency, Sundress Publications, and more. In 2023, she received nominations for the Pushcart Prize and Best New Poets Anthology. Her debut book, Blood, Skin, and Water, is available online through World Stage Press and at Broadway Books in Portland, Oregon. Camille, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Excited to have this conversation. So before we get started talking about your debut book, Blood, Skin, and Water, I'd love to talk about what got you to this point of being a debut author. Where did your writing journey, your fiber artistry journey, where did that all begin?
Yeah, this question always kind of stumps me because I don't remember when I first started writing. I just remember always writing, which I know that wasn't the case because obviously you don't pop out the womb just already knowing how to read and write. I think spiritually, so to say, like my love for writing and for arts in general definitely comes from my family. My great grandmother, her name was Elizabeth. She was the first published author in my family. She wrote a whole book, and she was also a choir director or a musical director at this huge Baptist church in San Francisco. And so she's like, yeah, I think of her as like the matriarch of my artistic practice, even though I never knew her. I never met her. She passed away way before I was born. Yeah, it's kind of funny how as I've come into specifically my poetry practice, but just my artistic practice in general, and sharing that with my family members, I keep on learning all these new stories like, oh, you know, your grandmother used to crochet. you know, your great grandmother wrote a book. Did you know, even my mom, she like wrote a short story that was almost like novella-ish that got published in her like town's newspaper when she was a teenager. So it's in my blood, like this creativity.
That's incredible. And to have Blood, Skin, and Water be the title of your book. What was Elizabeth's book about?
I'm not entirely sure because I haven't been able to find it. It's probably one of my family members probably has it. But it was called Reminiscence. And it was kind of, it was nonfiction. I'm not sure if it was memoir-based. Actually, I think it's mentioned in her obituary, which I have hanging up here above my desk. But I would love to find it one day and read it.
So it sounds like family is somewhat important to you, some kind of ancestry. You have your great-grandmother's obituary over your desk. I don't typically go in with the cards like this soon into the conversation, but just one of them that is that we've pulled here that's calling out to me is the Chariot. So the reason why I've pulled or the reason why the Chariot is kind of like speaking to me now is because the Chariot is associated with the sign of Cancer, and Cancer is so much associated with the matrilineage, with grandmothers, with the ancestry, with our roots, with like the emotional resonance of our past and those who have come before us in our lineage. So tell me more about how that has influenced you as a writer. Is that part of the theme, some of the themings in your debut book here?
Absolutely. My like short thesis of Blood, Skin, and Water is that it's a testament to being in spite of it all, despite it all, whatever word resonates for you there. But it really is like a letter of love as much as it is a letter of lament to my personal Black American familial history, as well as like the collective history as a Black person in America, but also a disabled person, also a queer person. And so I like to say that I'm too obsessed with the past to not want to speak hope for a better future. And so a lot of my work, I don't want to say it's rooted in the past because it really is rooted in the present, but it's always in conversation with the past. I think a lot of my mission as a poet is to honor my ancestors, my direct ancestors, but also, you know, the collective ancestors of the identities that I represent and I belong to. But yeah, I just really aim to honor them through my work as well as like keep those of us here in the present as anchored as we can be, knowing that, you know, we are a part of a community that historically has had a very rough time in this country.
To say the least.
To say the least, yeah. That was the nice way to put it.
I wanna highlight that phrase that you said, that sentence. Was it, I'm too obsessed with the past to not have hope for the future?
Yeah, and that's a line in a poem I just wrote. What is it? I'm too obsessed with the past to not shape a hope for the future, or something like that. This is a little tangent. I just performed at the Festival of Books in LA last week or 2 weeks ago at this point. Can't even keep track of time, but I found myself needing to write like an introduction poem because I felt like it was just such a new audience. And yeah, that's where that line came from. I was just thinking like, how do I tell my poetic mission in a 2 minute piece? And that's kind of where that came from.
I love that. And I think that's going to sit with me for a little while, or I'm going to sit with that sentence for a little while, because I feel similarly. And because it so perfectly encapsulates these two cards that we've pulled for your past here. Like, again, talking about the Chariot as the past, talking about the Chariot as what has come before us, talking about the Chariot as maybe some of the collective memory, thinking about, and these aren't necessarily standard significations of the Chariot as a tarot card in and of itself, but they are significations for the sign of Cancer, which is the sign associated with the Chariot. But then thinking about that understanding of the past, that obsession, like you said, with the past, having the past be so much of a focus in your mind that it gives purpose and meaning and drive and forward motion to you as a vessel, as a creator. And that really feels very Chariot as well, because the Chariot is so much about the direction of the will. It is about moving forward. But with it, again, being connected to Cancer, it's moving forward with a strong understanding of the past. And this idea of hope and of wanting to shape the future and of wanting to maybe design or artistically create the future is very Page of Wands, which is the other card that we've pulled here. So the Page of Wands is this lovely figure who is deeply curious, is deeply creative, is extremely hopeful. I would put hope on one, maybe the top of the list for keywords, key significations for the Page of Wands, because there's so much in all of the pages. All of the pages can be very hopeful because they're young. In many ways, they're naive. They don't have a ton of life experience, but they have that vigor for life that we find, you know, in children most often. They're associated with children and young people. And the Page of Wands in particular is so deeply creative because wands is this like fiery creative energy. So that sentence, I what was it again?
Neither of us could get it right.
I'm too obsessed with the past. I'm so obsessed with the past, like, to have hope. Oh,
to not want to get it right. Let me just open up the reference files.
Too obsessed with the past. We gotta get the reference text.
Let me see. I'm too obsessed with the past to not want to shape a hope for the future. I think that's what I said earlier, so I did get it right.
You nailed it earlier. I'm too obsessed with the past to not want to shape a hope for the future. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Shaping a hope for the future is very, very Page of Wands. So how has this sentiment, this philosophy, perhaps, this kind of rooted core belief, how did that start showing up even when you were young?
That's a great question. I honestly think it's a lot of it comes from growing up in a family that is so close-knit. Both of my parents have quite a few siblings, my dad more so than my mom. But we all lived in the same area except for a couple of my uncles. So, you know, my brother and my cousins and I, we all kind of grew up together and we saw our aunts and uncles and second, third cousins. We just spent a lot of time together. And I think naturally when that happens, you start exchanging stories. And I still, to this day, when I see my Uncle Al, who's my dad's older brother, I always ask him, I'm like, tell me a story about my dad. Tell me about your childhood. Tell me about my grandparents, you know, because my dad's parents passed away before I was born. And then my mom's parents passed away when I was between the ages of like 6 and 8, I think. And so I also think like experiencing so much death and so much tragedy early on in my life, my parents put a heavy emphasis on like knowing our familial roots, knowing our ancestors who came before us, and knowing what makes me and why and how I should be proud of that. My parents very early on like told my brother and I about like the legacy of American chattel slavery and how we are descendants of slaves, and how, you know, even my great grandfather, which, you know, down the family tree, that's not very long ago, you know, how he sacrificed so much and worked so hard to get out of Texas to get to the West Coast. And so, yeah, I guess I this is a very long-winded way of saying, like, these ideals were instilled in me at an early age because of my parents and because of my aunts and uncles.
It's a tragic and terrible legacy, but it's beautiful to have that legacy instilled in you and to understand the strength behind it and to be able to carry those stories forward despite the intentions of the colonizers and the enslavers and the people in power who would have loved and preferred to have you not be able to carry that legacy forward and to not be able to share those stories. So that's beautiful that you are in the space now to be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really have to credit my parents and my grandparents, because they're the ones who taught my parents of instilling this feeling of Black pride in me from the very beginning. Like, I have known that I'm Black since I was like 4 or 5 years old. And we have always revered our Blackness and always have talked about it in such like a positive and powerful light. And so I'm very grateful that I grew up loving who I am, loving that part of my identity.
And how does that identity show up in your work now, in Blood, Skin, and Water, in the other works that you've put out, in your fiber arts as well?
I struggle to say that my poetry is for everyone because I write to such a specific audience. I think when I'm writing, 99% of the time, I am writing under the assumption that someone who is Black and or queer and or disabled will read this work. I'm losing my train of thought.
Well, follow up question. Do you think art should be created for everyone?
No.
No.
And, you know, now that I'm reflecting on this, I'm like, this is a byproduct of my parents raising me with such Black pride, is that I have for a long time had this knowledge that Black Americans, we have our own stuff. We have our own TV networks and our own movies and our own music and our own books and stuff. And when you're living in a world or in a society that loves white supremacy and thrives off of white supremacy, it's so essential to like have your own thing, have your own world. And for me growing up, like, that was Black music, that was R&B and funk and rap, and that was all the, you know, Black comedies that have now aged so poorly. But, you know, like, yeah, I
think the Proud Family is just I think they survived.
The Proud Family survived. I just started
as a non-Black white Hispanic person adding my 2 cents where they don't belong.
Usually, if it was on Disney Channel, like, it like That's So Raven aged perfectly, is still so relevant, is still, you know, contributing to current conversations years later. But I'm just thinking about, I just started collecting like DVDs of old Black movies. They're literally from the 90s and early 2000s. But like, so many of
that's
the jokes are
now.
Like, they are vintage, but so many of the jokes are like homophobic and fatphobic. And I'm like,
while we're on the topic, this interview isn't going to necessarily come out until like June, if not July. But the Met Gala just happened yesterday. Was that yesterday? Very recently.
I couldn't even tell you.
With the theme being Black dandyism. Do you have any thoughts on anyone's Met Gala looks on the theme?
I actually am kind of late to reviewing all the looks. There's a couple TikTokers that I go to their pages and watch all of their reactions and stuff. I like have not really been online a lot post festival books because I'm just like so tired of being inundated with various informations. Yeah. I did see Colin Domingo's look, which he's just everything to me. So of course I loved it. And I saw Zendaya's, she Ooh, have like a white
yeah, the white suit
with the huge hat was so good.
Yeah, I think Colman Domingo was a co-chair for the event, I believe.
Sounds right.
His reveal once, because he started in like a cape and then the cape came off and he was in this impeccable suit, and his was one of my favorite looks of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I really pay attention at all to the Met Gala. Like, I'm still questioning if it was yesterday or the day before. I think it was yesterday.
Yeah, I'm like, I've seen pictures. Like, when did it happen?
I know it happened. I know that there was a lot of looks that I liked. Most, if not all of those, were worn by Black people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the non-Black folks necessarily hit the mark in a lot of ways. Doja Cat had one of my favorite looks.
Okay, I'll have to look.
You gotta check out Doja Cat's look.
I'm pretty sure the only two looks I've seen have been Zendaya and Colman Domingo, because I follow
really
them both on Instagram. Yeah,
that's
exactly
all you need at this point. We don't need to worry about the rest. Oh my gosh, I just had to ask, since it's topical, it's on my mind, and it's what we're talking about. How you know, Black culture, and how in some ways the intersections with the mainstream here with the Met Gala and this theme. But tell me a little bit more about the premise of your debut book, and how does it feel to call yourself a debut author?
It still doesn't feel real a lot of the times, and I think that's just like something I have to work on with my own personal things. When I was at the Festival of Books, my best friend was my plus one, and I kept on being like, how did I weasel my way in here? Like, how am I here? And she was like, I'm going to hold your hand while I'm saying this. Like, you are a good writer. You have a book. You're an artist. You're supposed to be here. And I was like, oh, yeah. Like, that's so right. So, yeah, it's still a little strange basking in this new chapter and in these new accomplishments, because I feel like I was working towards them for so long that you kind of, not that you forget that there will be a reward at the end, but when it happens, it's easy to be like, well, there's so much more that I need to do, or so much more that I want to do post that. But yeah, as far as the premise of my book, it's divided into three sections. So there's the blood section, which is really speaking to that Black American familial legacy. The skin section is, you know, how that manifests in the present, how I show up in the world as a Black queer disabled person. And then the water section is actually, it comes about throughout the book. So it's really two sections with the water poems like flowing throughout the book. But that's kind of the spiritual, the ethereal, a lot of the lamentations are in the water section as well, because a lot of those poems were just when I like needed a rinse, needed a spiritual cleanse. I needed the water to flow through me and heal me in that way.
First of all, I love that idea of water, poems that are water, that are cleansing for you as the writer, and then for the reader once they pick up that book and have that in their library. That's gorgeous.
Thank you.
I'm curious, how long was the process of writing this, and when did you finish?
Some of these poems I wrote like freshman year of college and forgot I even had them, and then revisited. This whole book pretty much came about because I took part in this program called the Community Literature Initiative out of LA. They are the same organization as the Sims Library of Poetry. And so they have two different classes. One is a children's book writing class and one is a poetry publishing class. So that's like a 10-month long commitment where you're in community with other poets and with an instructor, and you're learning the craft and you're writing poems and you're working on a manuscript and you're learning about the industry of book publishing and book marketing and all those things. So it was a really incredible program. And I completed that in 2023. And then my book was published in April of 2024. So we just passed the 1 year anniversary. Yeah, thank you of the publishing of my first book, which it seems like it's been out longer because I've done so much around this book in a year, which has just been, yeah, it's just been a huge blessing and a really fun ride.
Well, congratulations. Happy 1 year anniversary to Blood, Skin, and Water.
Thank you.
And so it's been quite a journey to getting this out. And now it's here. It's out in the world. How has the postpartum experience been?
Yeah, it's been great. Probably much easier than actual postpartum experiences of actual parents, birthing parents. But I remember we had a guest speaker in one of our classes who, you know, they said something along the lines of like, this is your first book and it's such an important milestone and it's such a huge accomplishment and you're going to get it published and you're going to, you know, do so much with your first book. And then you're going to look back at how much you've grown and feel like that warrants a second book. And they were kind of making the point of like, a lot of times your first book feels very internal and a lot of the work feels almost biographical in a way. And then a shift happens in the second book where your work feels like it's more so for the world or for your community or whoever your audience is. And so I think I'm kind of in that period now where, of course, I love my book and I'm so proud of it. And I'm proud of what I was able to accomplish. But I'm already like, there are so many things I would have done different. And I feel like I've already grown so much as an artist that I'm like, this represents a different chapter in my life than I feel like I'm currently in right now. So it's been interesting in that way.
Interesting. And in some of that, I'm hearing a reflection of at least one of the cards that we have pulled for your present state right now. So thinking about these cards being a reflection of not only your phase that you're in at the moment, which that's going to be my follow-up. I'm going to ask you about that in a second. But also a reflection of the work that just came out, a year ago, the book that came out a year ago that is still kind of like the thing that is here, the work that you're out promoting.
It's the baby.
The festival.
Yeah.
It's the baby. The baby gets lots of attention when for a few years, the baby is the center. I just got a text as we're conversing. I have my phone set up in front of me and I got a text asking about what time should we do the baby's third birthday party? And I'm like, oh, yes. Everything revolves around the baby. So I'm hearing that the first book is sometimes feeling more autobiographical, feeling more personal, feeling more like a very intimate, internally focused experience of the content and then the process of getting it out into the world. And so I'm seeing that reflected in the Nine of Wands here, because the Nine of Wands, like we said earlier with the page, the wands are so much about the creative process, the art making, what you're putting out into the world, what you're exerting energy towards, what your life force energy, your chi, your prana, your mana, whatever you want to call it, is like focused on. And with nines, they can be somewhat isolating. It can be kind of like the individual experience a lot of times we need to ask for help when the nines come up. So it does sound like you had some help by going through that program that you talked about. But also that had to have been an extremely like personal process for you mm-hmm. at the same time. And when we look at the image of this card, it's, you know, a lone candelabra. There's nine mm-hmm. candles on it, but they're all on one candelabra in this like darkened room. We can see nothing else in the room. We just see out the windows that the sun is starting to rise mm-hmm. in the background. The moon is setting, the sun is rising, and the candles are on their way to being burnt all the way out. So thinking about you going on this like solo journey to kind of plumb the depths of what it is that you want to say, what you have to express, what you have to share, of course, calling in, again, talking about the Chariot and that connection to mm-hmm. Cancer, calling in the ancestral wisdom, calling in the connection to your roots, but having this piece of work be a very personal process is kind of what I'm seeing in here. Your writing process is, I'm not a writer. I'll preface this by saying I am not a writer.
Everyone always says that, and then they're like, can I send you a poem? And it's like, it like moves me to tears. It's so beautiful. So
I'm not a writer, but I do have some writings on my Patreon if you want to check them out.
By white supremacist standards, maybe not, but my poetry practice is very radical in that way, where I believe in inventing your own form and language and grammar and all those things. So I believe that you are a good writer.
I do. I don't like the process of writing, but what I'm trying to get at is your process, mm-hmm. your writing process. Is it like a solo experience? Like, are you the mm. kind of person who likes to kind of shut yourself in your workspace and be alone? Or are you someone who likes to get your writing done maybe out in public, at a park, in a coffee shop? What does it look like when you're in your writer mode?
Yeah, that's a fabulous question. Again, another guest speaker in this class. I can never remember who said what, so sorry if I'm not crediting anyone. I just bad memory. But we had another guest speaker in our class come, and we were talking about the writing process, and they had said something along the lines of a poet's practice isn't just on the page. Like, you have to go and live life and experience life and observe and read other poets, but other writers, other people, period. You have to engage with the world around you to be able to have like a fulfilling poetry practice. And that feels very accurate to me as well, especially because I'm a Sagittarius sun. I love adventure. I love to travel. I love living life. And so for me, that's where my poetry practice really starts. I do love to write in community with other poets. I do partake in various, you know, workshops and writing groups and things like that. But I do love when I have my moments to kind of just like be a hermit and hunker down and just like be alone with the page in my thoughts and my ancestors. And usually that happens kind of late at night. I'm a night owl. I love when it's quiet and no one's really outside and the air is very cool and my cats are sleeping and my boyfriend's sleeping. I love that alone time. So that's where, that's where a lot of my dreaming happens as well, not only just my writing, but just my manifesting for what I want within my poetry practice.
That beautiful hope for the future, that shaping and creating.
Chronic optimist, me.
Sagittarius. That's why we love a Sagittarius. It's necessary.
We need you.
We need you all aiming your arrows so far beyond that the rest of us can't see yet.
We're trying so hard.
So I've been asking you probing questions because I'm trying to figure out where this other card fits into the current situation. And I'm hearing that a lot of your writing time, your expression time comes when things are quiet and still at night. When other creatures in the house, boyfriends and cats, are sleeping. And so I think that's some of what is connecting to this card here. We have the Four of Swords. So swords being connected to the element of air. So deeply connected to writing, communicating, poetry, words, how we express ourselves more in a mental realm versus the expression, the creative expression of wands, which is much more in the like passionate, fiery, like true art making realm. So poetry is a really beautiful overlap of fire and air together, the creative expression through the written word. And with the Four of Swords in particular, it is very much about stillness. Mm-hmm. It's a card that I often associate with meditation. It's a card that I associate with like quieting the mind, letting things get really still, get really quiet to create space for whatever to come in, to come into the mind. So I'm seeing a little bit of that reflected in what you're talking about the night, the quiet of the night being a good place for you to dream and to write. This card, in the Smith-Waite version of this card, it does look like a figure almost sleeping, like they almost look like they're in a tomb, but they could also be just resting, sleeping, but like on their back, arms crossed, in a very a place that does appear to, it looks very sacred. In this like quiet, still, sacred place. So in this version of the card, we have a cicada that is, what's the word? It's under the ground, incubating, like a cicada that's incubating.
Yeah, it's all like curled up.
Yeah, it's just, nice it's in there, it's in the dirt. It's just having, yeah, having a 10-year long nap, something like that. And just quiet. What phase do you feel like you're in right now? So, the debut book is out. It's been published for a year. You've been promoting it. You've been doing the work to talk that up. But you said earlier that you feel like you're in a different phase at this time. So what does the current phase look like?
Yeah, the current phase that I'm trying to manifest is a restful one, is one where I have more space to start writing again and really sit with my writing and meditate on it. It's been very, for the past year, for the past 2 years, it's been very nonstop. And I mentioned beforehand, there's just my own personal things I need to work through when it comes to resting, period, and unlearning these capitalistic beliefs of always having to do something or always having to like outwardly produce something. So I actually, I'll be at a writing residency in the fall on the Oregon coast, and I'm so looking forward to just like being, just going there and like not really having any requirements to produce anything or prove anything. Even though I hope, you know, to write a lot and produce a lot of things, but without the expectation of like having to monetize them or like having to share them with anyone. I think also I got really sick at the beginning of this year in like December, January, and that has really taken a toll on my lupus symptoms. I previously was like in remission from my symptoms. Things were going so well. And then I just got hit with this crazy virus that just caused a lot of other things to spiral. And so I'm in this interesting place now where I require much more rest than I ever have before. But I also feel much more pressure to do the things I need to do to survive. And a lot of the ways that I am making money to survive right now is through my poetry and through my fiber artistry. And so I really have been searching for a balance and coming to terms with the fact that every day is going to look different. I used to say every week is going to look different. I'm not going to know how I'm going to feel when I wake up, but it's to the point now where it's like, I can only plan so much the day before because I just have to take things in stride and just trust that, like, my ancestors will carry me and that, you know, the rent will get paid, the groceries will get bought. And so far they have. Things have been working out. So it's a really delicate spot. There is a lot of opportunity to feel incredibly stressed and feel like I need to be working. And then on the other hand, I kind of have these moments where I'm like, I'm alive and that's enough. You know, I can celebrate in that aliveness. I can rest in this aliveness.
The cards, the present cards are making a lot more sense now as you talk about this. I'm so sorry to hear that the lupus has been flaring up this year. Also, my brain rot. As soon as you said that, my brain went, okay, Selena Gomez.
My lupus lawyer twin.
I was like, don't say that.
She's like my one problematic fave because she has lupus. Oh. It's like her and Halsey. I'm like, I can't turn against my lupus sisters. I can't.
I'm going to see Halsey literally in like 5 days. And oh my gosh. I just recorded a deep dive astrology breakdown of Halsey and their life and career with my good friend Tasha, former guest on the pod, who is the pop astrologist, and she does the Pop Astrologist Presents. So you're gonna have to, in your rest, as you are resting and giving your brain space to allow for new art to come in, you'll have to check out that Halsey episode because we had so much fun. I love Halsey, and yes, Halsey and Selena, both problematic lupus faves. Warriors. Faves. I love Selena Gomez.
Perfect.
As another problematic fave, Miley Cyrus said, nobody's perfect.
No, I gotta work it.
The cards, like I said, are really making a lot of sense for this phase that you're in of like forced rest.
Mm-hmm.
And as someone who has been in those phases many times, you know, I have my own chronic illness issues and journeys. Those forced rest periods suck. They're really annoying when you have dreams and goals and things you want to do. But that makes sense that you would be in that phase post this like major the release of this major project, the debut book. And so now that's been flushed out and it's kind of like back in that pause moment and in a bit of a pause moment to allow for like the spaciousness. You're at like the bottom of the exhale, like the exhale has happened. You're at the bottom there and it is a moment that has to exist in its own right before the inhale can come again. Or perhaps you're in the inhale and you just have to be taking in external things rather than producing and creating on your own. So the Four of Swords, everything I said about the Four of Swords really makes sense and resonates even more for me now, having heard you talk about the phase that you're in this moment. That residency sounds very cool. Do you want to tell me a little bit about what that's going to look like?
Yeah, so I'm actually waiting to learn a little bit more information next week, but the overall premise of it, it's at the Sitka Center for Art and Ecology, which is on the Oregon coast. Don't ask me the name of the city. I already forgot, but it's like 2 hours from Portland. And I actually applied through a partner of Sitka through this organization called Portland in Color. So they do a lot of work with increasing access to certain programs and funding opportunities and just various opportunities for artists of color in Portland. So this is the first year that Portland in Color is partnering with the Sitka Center. So I'm honored to be one of the first to be representing the program in that way. But yeah, I'll be staying on campus at this Art and Ecology Center. I'll have a little writing studio and I'll be in community with various artists of various disciplines. They made it really clear that there's no expectation to produce anything or do anything big while you're there. They really just want to provide a space for you to do whatever you need that's going to benefit your writing practice. And so I even said that in my application. I was like, honestly, I'm going to rest. Like, I'm tired. Of course, I want to write and spend time in nature because those are like two of my favorite things ever. But, you know, primarily, I feel like I need a little cleanse. I need a little rest. So, yeah, I'm very excited.
I can't imagine a better place than to go to the coast.
And I know.
Especially that beautiful coast up in, you said Oregon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not Washington.
In Oregon, okay. Yeah.
I'm like, I rarely make it up to the Pacific Northwest. So I'm like, it's all the same to me. But that should be beautiful.
I'm sure people from here have stronger feelings than I do on the matter. But I also think Washington is very beautiful. So love Oregon. Love Oregon. But Washington does something to me when I'm up there.
So looking even beyond... looking to this residency and even beyond it, What are your hopes and dreams and manifestations and goals for yourself as an artist moving forward?
Yeah, I have been working on starting my own poetry publishing house for a couple months now. I unfortunately have not had the bandwidth that I wish that I had or the funds that I wish that I had to really focus on that. But that's my ultimate goal. I think now being on the other side of the publishing industry, like being an artist who's trying to get published. Yeah, I through my experience publishing my own book, I had this vision of how I wanted to serve other writers and other poets like me. Oftentimes, major publishers, they don't really want to hear from writers like me unless it is a very traumatic story or a story that's palatable to the white gaze. And I was very fortunate to get my book published on a Black-owned press, a small press in LA. And that experience really proved to me that I could do this, that this dream of having more Black voices and queer voices and disabled voices telling their whole truth the way they want to tell it, that it can be achieved. So ultimately, that's like my big picture goal that I know will happen someday. I'm not sure entirely when, but if I do one thing in my life, it's going to be that. But right now in the short term, I would just love for my poetry to support me in a more comfortable way, which I kind of have mixed feelings about because I try to approach my poetry in an anti-capitalist mindset, but I also have to be real about the fact that, like, I need money to go to the doctor and afford my medication and pay my rent. And so, yeah, I would love to be able to make more of a living off of my poetry. So we'll see. We'll see. I'm trying.
I would love that for you as well.
Thank you.
And hearing your vision of a publishing company, it's reminding me of something that Pamela Coleman Smith achieved in her lifetime. And Pamela Coleman Smith, for those who don't know, is the original artist for the classic traditional Smith-Waite tarot deck. So if you Google tarot deck, if you Google like tarot cards, the imagery you're most likely to see come up first and come up repeatedly is the Smith-Waite tarot deck, which is commonly known as the Rider-Waite tarot deck. Rider was the sort of creative director and man behind the project. He was the man behind the project. Waite was the original publisher, and Pamela Coleman Smith was the artist and illustrator who drew every single card in the deck, some of which was like channeled, most of which was only given very minimal direction by Arthur Edward Waite. So that's why I refer to that deck as the Smith-Waite deck, because I think she needs to be acknowledged in the name and also acknowledged first, because she did a heck of a lot of the work. And if we're going alphabetically, her name would be first. S is before W.
So many reasons.
So many reasons, even practical ones, like alphabetization. But Pamela Coleman Smith, she's an incredible figure from history. But she also, I believe, it's been a while since I've taught my history of the tarot class, so I haven't brushed up on this history in a minute. But I believe that she also created a publishing company that specifically sought to highlight and to work with female artists and women of color artists, because Pamela Coleman Smith was a, I believe, biracial woman. There was Black ancestry in there. I can't remember if there was also white ancestry in there. but that's reminding me of that. So a little bit of tarot history for the listeners, because I think that's fascinating. And I would love to see that be achieved. In terms of the cards that we have coming up, one of them at least is giving me a little indication that this could very well be in your future. We have the Wheel of Fortune coming up, which is a very dramatic card of change, but it is specifically associated with the planet Jupiter. Jupiter is associated with the Wheel of Fortune. There's a little Jupiter glyph drawn on the leg of this person there. And Jupiter is a planet that can very well be associated with publishing. And Jupiter is also the ruler of Sagittarius. Sagittarius is also a sign that's associated with publishing and with like publishing houses, like traditionally all fall under this like Jupiterian, Sagittarian, very ninth house in astrology kind of realm. So I would love to see that for you, but certainly change is coming for the future. If we've got the Wheel of Fortune coming up, certainly change. And the accompanying card for the Wheel of Fortune is another card in the suit of swords. So for those keeping track at home, we've had two wands, two swords, and two major arcana cards come up. And I love that combination because, like I said earlier, wands and swords together, that is like poetry, that is creative writing. Like if we're being extremely literal, that would be a great keywords for wands and swords is creative writing. But change, liminality. I did an interview with a writer and artist who described themselves as very liminal. And we talked about how the numbers 5 and 7 are very liminal numbers, meaning like in the in-between spaces, like not here nor there, but somewhere in between, in process. And the 7 of Swords is what's come up to accompany the Wheel of Fortune. So there is change, evolution, portals to enter into, unknowns to explore, in terms of your creative writing moving forward is very much what I'm seeing in these cards here. Yeah. How does that sit with you hearing that?
Yeah, I have felt for like since September, at least, that I'm at this sort of turning point. September is when I left my corporate job that was slowly but surely killing me to pursue a more restful lifestyle and a more creative career. But yeah, I have been focusing on staying open to whatever opportunities come to me and whatever possibilities may be lying out there. I think traditionally, I've been the type of person who like loved to follow a set path. I did the thing of getting good grades in high school so I could go to a good college and get my degree so I can work a corporate job. I did all that and I did not love it. You know, I got to where I was trying to go and it wasn't what I expected. And so as uncomfortable as it makes me to lean into the unknown, I really have been trying to lean into the unknown. And as far as my poetry practice, I keep on bringing up the LA Times Festival books, but it really was the best weekend I've had in a very long time. And I just remembered, I guess, that I can do more than poetry. I can write more than poetry. And I have all these like short story ideas that I've written down, but never really sat down to actually pursue. And I had also just read my first novel that was written in verse, and that kind of just like awakened something in me. And so, yeah, for this kind of future chapter, like I am really hoping just to like put my writing practice first and in a way that's like, of course, it's going to feel like work because it is an avenue for, you know, my financial life and for funding my lifestyle. But I kind of want to go back to that place when I was in middle school and high school where it's like I opened a book and I felt like I was at home. Like, wow, I'm back here with my stories. Or I open my journal and just like physically writing on the page just like healed me in a way, or made me feel safe, made me feel like I was supposed to be here in this moment doing this. So I want to get back to that space where I'm putting my writing first and doing it in a way that not only serves my readers and serves my community, but ultimately like nourishes me, because I can't nourish others if I'm depleted. And I think I've been operating from a space of depletion for so long. I can't even say how many years it's been, but for a very long time. And it's difficult to get out of those habits. It really is.
I want that for you. I want to see you out of a state of depletion. And I hope that this residency will be a really potent time for you to find some rest and some spaciousness.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Me too.
Well, Camille, where can folks find you if they're interested in reading your work, purchasing your book, exploring what you have to say?
Absolutely. You can find me on Instagram at Camille Terry Creative. That's Terry with a Y because, you know, it's cute. You can find me on TikTok. I don't really post that much on TikTok, so maybe don't find me there. Maybe find me on Instagram first.
Editor's note, Camille recently posted a TikTok of her reading a really incredible poem and it blew up because it was awesome. So definitely go find her on TikTok so you can watch that video.
I have a link tree link in my bio and there's the link to my book, and I put my festival book set on YouTube so you can watch that there as well. And my Venmo is Camille-McDaniel. If you ever want to send me some coin, I can use it.
Heck yeah. Heck yeah. Send Camille some coin. And I love that, like, every... Are you a millennial? Are you a millennial or are you Gen Z?
I'm a millennial. I was born in 96, okay. So I'm one of those weirdos so who's, like, trapped
well
in the middle.
Be. I would, for me personally, I judge generations by what sign your Pluto is in.
Oh,
so I would have
no,
to look at your chart to determine. There's a good chance that you are, I'm pretty sure you're Pluto in Aries. Not necessarily have to be, but you're probably Pluto in Aries,
let
which
me
make
see.
You a Gen Zer. Pull up the chart.
I love Gen Zers, so...
I do, too. We have
my
a...
My Pluto's in Sagittarius.
Your Pluto is in... Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know why I said Aries.
Fire
it would have
sign.
Been Scorpio or Sagittarius. So, yes, Pluto in Sagittarius, you are a Gen Z. I was going to say that I love how most of my, like, millennial folks that I've interviewed will be like, yeah, we're on TikTok, but we mostly just shitpost over there. Like, there's nothing going on. I'm not really posting. It's nothing serious. I have, like, 200 views over there. Don't worry about it. But if you like stupid stuff, check that out. But you're a Gen Zer, so you should really be all over the TikTok, apparently.
I know. I think I just have an old soul. I think it's also because I'm the youngest. I only have one sibling, but I think my older sibling being 3 years older than me aged me 3 years in a way, like when it comes to pop culture things and whatever. So, yeah,
so you're a millennial
I
at heart.
I love TikTok to like repost in Kiki in the comments and stuff. But I'm too lazy to make content. I really don't like it.
I think I'm too choogy to make content. My content is so deeply millennial. Like, I'm also sort of on the cusp where I'm friends with a lot of Gen Z. We're like kind of in the same age range. But I am firmly a millennial. My Pluto is in Scorpio. So I firmly place myself in the millennial generation. And yeah, I post some embarrassing TikToks sometimes, and
listen,
I'm proud of it.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Like, as long as you're, this is the Gen Z way. As long as you're being your authentic self, you're doing it right.
Heck yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much, Camille, for talking to me today. This has been a very fun conversation. And everyone, send Camille some coin. Go check out her poetry. Go check out their debut book. And keep an eye out for the next one, because I know it'll arrive in absolutely divine timing.
Thank you. I love that. I'm going to start saying that because people ask me, what is the next book? And I'm going to say, in divine timing.
When the stars align. Amen. Awesome. Thank you to everyone who listened today. And as always, happy shuffling.
Thank you.